And do your levels change when you read?
Yeah, usually when I'm talking about writing.
When I think of home, I think of a resting place. A place where there's peace, quiet, and serenity. And that's where some of my friends have gone. Friends who have traveled with me through my wonderful experience in Oz. A journey I'll never forget. When I think of home, I think of a place where there's love overflowing. I wish I was home, I wish I was back there with the things I've been knowing. When night makes the tall grass bend into leaves, suddenly the raindrops that fall, they have a meaning, sprinkling the sea, makes it all.
Hetzel, and I'm so glad you're here on this wintry end of January day. I'm so happy, so very happy to have the Efua Prince here in the studio with me. Efua, welcome to WCBN FM Ann Arbor.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for driving in through from Detroit.
Yes.
To join us. And I didn't even ask how your drive was. I'm very rude.
Oh, no, it was perfectly fine. It was a very smooth drive.
Okay. And knock on wood that we're going to have it this way. We are gathered here today with your book on the table out with Wayne State University Press. It's a Made in Michigan Writers Series book.
Yes.
And the title is Kin, Practically True Stories. Yeah. I love this title. I mean, and also, and to describe everyone, you can also go to Efua's website as well to check out the beautiful cover, or you can go to Wayne State University's site. The cover and the title, to start with, I guess, at the very beginning here with the book, beautiful.
Thank you. The artwork on the cover, I might say, was a piece my daughter made for her senior project as an undergrad at Allegheny College. So that is her image that they used for the cover.
How were you able to swing that? It's beautiful. Were they just, they saw it and they knew?
They didn't see. I brought it to them and I was like, I would love if this is possible. And then they loved it too. Yeah.
And what's your daughter's name?
Her name is Imani.
Imani?
Yes.
Prince?
Yes.
So the artist Imani Prince is featured.
Well, she uses her first and middle name, Imani Bell.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I don't think she, because everybody in my family are artists. My children's father is an artist. All three children are artists. So there are a lot of Prince artists. Their uncle on the father's side is an artist. So so she said, there are enough Prince artists. I need to distinguish myself.
And so she's going by Bell.
Yeah, her middle name and first name.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is. Can you describe it a little bit for us?
Yeah.
And
she had this thing for a while where she was doing these like celestial goddesses. And so they would be floating or flying or falling through space, and they would always be larger than life. This piece is huge. It's like, I don't know, 6 feet by 9 feet. It's a large charcoal drawing with this figure who's this kind of midnight blue skin against a starry, like outer space sky. And then her hair has like traditionally what we might call cornrows, but they are really, they look like rows that have been cultivated and trees are growing up. Instead of hair, she has a, you know, she has a forest. And I just love her, the seriousness of her eyes.
Yes. It's
very striking.
It's intense.
Yeah.
Her eyes here. And was this, was your daughter influenced by your, the work?
I wish she was.
Kin? Because there's like a section, branches, the tree yeah. is like the central trunk of the, like the figure. I just felt like the piece was made for the book.
I wish I could claim that, but I can't.
But it's interesting that both of you were thinking in mm-hmm. similar
yeah.
ways of symbols and about family and,
yeah.
And the power of women.
Well,
and the resiliency.
I do think, for whichever way it works in families, she definitely has that as a central, the power of women. She's into generations, and she really likes her, the idea of sisterhood. She doesn't have a sister. I don't have a sister. My mother doesn't have a sister. Her daughter is right now the only girl. So there are generations that we have to reach to each other up and down because we don't have sisters. We have brothers, but we don't have sisters. And so I think that impacts us.
Yeah. And it, mm-hmm. and it's a different kind of strength in the family tree.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly mm-hmm. a different way to mm-hmm. to feel it. Like it's through lines and it's roots.
Mm-hmm. Roots and branches. And her middle name, Belle, is from my grandmother, my maternal grandmother. So her name was Nellie Belle. And I named my daughter after my grandmother. Oh. So maybe I imprinted her.
Yes, because mm-hmm. I think we carry our parts of our loved ones with us, the ones mm-hmm. that we've known and when they've gone, or ones that we haven't known mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. Is the grandmother that you're mentioning, your maternal grandmother, does she figure in as the grandmother in Kin as well?
Yes, she's at the end in Empty Vessel.
I wrote elder power at the end of that story.
Yeah, yeah. That was, and my mother tells me my memory is off. I have some things not right. She's like, nobody buries anybody on Thanksgiving. But in my mind, it feels so clear. I remember her being buried on Thanksgiving. So I didn't correct myself. I just left it because that's the way I remember it.
And okay, have you ever read Joan Didion's On Keeping a Notebook?
Mm-hmm,
that's
mm-hmm,
what
mm-hmm.
Joan would say, of course, because that's yeah. your memory is the way that it happened. Like, because yeah. everyone else will have a different memory.
Exactly. And that's part of why I play with genre.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's talk
it.
About that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because this is Kin, Practically True Stories,
mm-hmm.
is a book that almost defies being categorized because
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
there's fiction there's personal there's nonfiction in it
mm-hmm.
like this moment that we're talking about with
Correct.
You your
mm-hmm.
grandmother
mm-hmm.
the doctor like
yes.
in the last scene especially
yes
the spoon but let's talk about this playing with genre, stepping into multiple forms mm. and structures, and uniting them all in the covers of this book, Kin.
Yeah, it was a question of, for me, always when I write, and I think it's the good and the bad, right? People don't know what to do with me when I'm writing, and I don't always know what to do with myself. But what I don't want to do is force myself to be anything. And so I give myself the room to allow the story to emerge as it emerges. So sometimes it comes out as a poem. Most times it comes out as nonfiction. And then for this series of work, it was like the nonfiction could not tell the whole reality. And so the nonfiction blossomed into the form that could communicate best the truth I was trying to tell.
And some of these forms would mm-hmm. be
like short story or a one-act play. They just became different things or some other thing that I didn't have a name for.
Yes. For example, June.
Loved June.
We'll come back to June mm-hmm. because in Kin, you also have the element of like pieces that speak directly to Gene Toomer's Kane.
Yeah, he's a huge influence. A huge influence.
When did he come into your life and how? As like a writer thinker,
Early, I don't know. The book I have is from the 70s, so I know that's not. I was too young. That's not. So I don't know why my book is from the 70s, but I have a book of his from the 70s, and I've had it pretty much as long as I can remember when I started reading. I might have been in high school, but I suspect I was in college. Mm-hmm. But I remember reading it and not grasping it, like when we get to Cabness and there's a play and there are these lines and different kind of symbols and there are poems and there are all of these different pieces and there's movement and I'm like, what is happening? But it just fascinated me. And I just kept reading it and reading it and reading it. And so for as long as I can remember being like a kind of academic thinker, Gene Toomer has been part of my consciousness.
He's been he's in your family, your
mm-hmm.
literary family.
Yes. Yeah.
And I love that you say it's fascinating because there's some books where that can it almost kick you out a bit mm-hmm. as the reader. Like there might not be the space for you, but instead, even though it wasn't like crystal clear when you first went to it, mm-hmm. there was space that you knew was there for you, it sounds like, for you as a reader.
Yes, that's exactly right, because for him, it is true, there are works, like I struggled with Charles Johnson. I couldn't understand some of his writing, and I had to drag myself back to it to keep reading, or, you know, some academic writing like Houston Baker, but I love a challenge. So I don't usually give up. Yeah. If I don't understand it, it doesn't mean I'm going to give up on it. But with Gene Toomer, it was a very different response because there are all these images, these poetic moments where he pulls you in. And that's what there's a beauty to his language that has always been what I encounter first.
The beauty, mm-hmm. the beauty. And it's even like the sound or like the way the language mm-hmm. is working together, even mm-hmm. if the meaning of it isn't
correct.
Completely apparent.
Yeah. 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 There are levels for me. The reason I write is because I love the sound of language, the play of language, the flow, the feel. And sometimes understanding takes a back seat.
Yes. And is that how you draft too? Is that how when you're drafting and starting to create, mm-hmm. are you working out loud as well as on the page?
Mm-hmm. I work in a lot of ways.
Okay. Let's take a short break. Okay. We'll come back and let's start there. Okay.
Sure, absolutely.
Today on Living Writers, V. Afua Prince is here. So glad you're out there listening to. We've got Reverend Andrew behind the glass. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back.
You get a fast car. I want a ticket to anywhere. Maybe we make a deal. Maybe together we can get somewhere. Any place is better. Starting from zero, got nothing to lose. Maybe we'll make something. Me, myself, I got nothing to prove. You got a fast car.
I got a plan to get us out of here. Been working at the convenience store. Managed to save just a little bit of money. Won't have to drive too far. Just across the border and into the city. You and I can both get jobs and finally see what it means to be living. See, my old man's got a problem. Yeah, but the bottle, that's the way it is. He says his body's too old for working. His body's too young to look like his. My mama went off and left him. She wanted more from life than he could give. I said, somebody's got to take care of him. So I quit school and that's what I did. You got a fast car. Is it fast enough so we can fly away? We gotta make a decision. Leave tonight or live and die this way.
I'm glad you're here listening today, this January day. Today we've got V. Efua Prince here in the studio with her book out with Wayne State University Press, Kin, Practically True Stories. And we've jumped right into the book right away. So before we get back to talking about ways of working and ways of drafting and making, I'm going to read the short bio in the book. V. Efua Prince is a professor of African American Studies at Wayne State University who specializes in themes of home, women, and housework. She has previously served as a W.E.B. Du Bois Fellow at Harvard University, a visiting scholar at the Carter G. Woodson Institute, University of Virginia, and Avalon Professor of Humanities at Hampton University. Her first book, Burning Down the House, Home in African American Literature, was recognized by academia as a University Press bestseller. And we can add whatever you want to that, of course, because this is your bio.
That's good. Oh, I did get it. Ken got a couple of recognitions. Maybe that's since I sent the information. I don't know.
Oh.
It was long listed for the Carol Shield Prize in 2025.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful.
And it won an,
and that's for fiction, then.
Yes, for
so
fiction.
So that's how they're mapping on
well,
to Ken.
Well, I definitely would say it's primarily fiction.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. There is one essay that's pure nonfiction, and the rest of it is playful.
And is the Amrita essay the one that's nonfiction about Aunt Clytie?
Amrita, yeah.
Amrita, mm-hmm, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, yes, yes. That's the one that's nonfiction. It's kind of like right to me. It's like the center of the book.
It is?
And it goes out like this.
So it is the center.
Yeah.
And so that's like the visual, like what you're doing is sort of making like the central trunk of the tree
yeah.
and then having the branches come out.
Come out from it. And yeah, and I did it with my hands like the people on the radio could see my hands.
Like fanning them out. Yes. Thank you for describing.
Right. I'm so sorry about that.
No.
But yeah, it's like a tree. Yes. So Amrita is like the trunk of it and then the rest of it. And someone who early reviewer, she was like, well, I had to go back and start over again after I got to the end. And it was almost a critique. And I was like, no, you got it. You got it. That's the point.
That's like what you want.
And you even
mentioned that too.
Yeah.
In the book. Okay. Before I guide us into this other conversation, which I will try to remember to get back to, let's talk about your ways of working because that's where we left off before the break. Like how are you, like when you're drafting, mm-hmm. when you're creating,
mm-hmm.
How
does it work?
Yeah.
It works whatever way it works.
So, right.
So I don't.
Right.
Right. And you know, I really do think it has to do with the fact that I had children while I was going through grad school. I had two children while I was in school at University of Michigan.
Go blue.
And I had to write wherever. If I was stopped at a red light, I write on a piece of napkin. Or if I was changing a diaper, I had to write when and where. That idea of a room of one's own No, I didn't have a room of my own. I've never had. Well, now I actually do because my youngest child is 18. But it was a long time before I could get a room of my own. And so my writing practices were cultivated under stolen moments. If I had to wait until there was time, nothing would have ever been. I would have never finished my degree. I would have never written and published anything. I've never had the time. So I take the time. And because I take the time, that's part of, you know, it's like I accept and receive what I have as what I need to work with. And so that's why the genre, I'm not limiting myself in certain ways. So I just allow the writing to be whatever it is and to unfold however it unfolds.
So let's talk about Kin then with mm-hmm. Kin, Practically True Stories. Because I'm paging through it now. I don't know if everyone can hear it. We've got the table of contents. We have a preface that begins the book, mm-hmm. which is not always the norm for like a book of stories, mm-hmm. but these are practically true stories. Mm-hmm. So why did you start like with the preface? Because it's addressing in some ways what's to come, like to come, what to expect in the book, and mm-hmm. also some of the challenges of working with the publishing industry, mm-hmm. with categorizing your work.
Yeah, because there are expectations people have, and when you don't fit the expectation, then that can be a problem, can be read onto you. So it can be, oh, this is flawed, or this is accidental and needs to be corrected. And so,
instead of intentional.
Right. Or even if it's not intentional, it doesn't have to be flawed.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Right.
It can art.
Just allow.
Yes.
Right. Can't we just accept people? Can't we just allow people to be who they are? And so for me, going through graduate school, there was intense pressure. Well, I think graduate school generally is an assimilation process, right? You are training to fit into a profession and you have to learn the standards. You have to learn the norms. You have to understand the work that you are undertaking and to fit within the community of scholars.
So that they feel they recognize you.
Right. And so that you are sharing a vocabulary, there must be a standard. Like if you're trying to make a light bulb, it really helps that there's a standard so that if I go to the store and buy the bulb and bring it home, it fits. So I get that. I'm not opposed to that. And still, as an African-American woman who enters into a graduate program, there's intense pressure to change a whole lot of things that are really core to your identity, core to your community. It is, I remember going home and cooking a meal for my family, and my father was offended because he felt like I was attacking something that was core to him by changing the way I was cooking. There's tension on certain root levels for a lot of different things. So I go away and I learn things and I bring it home. And he's like, what have I done? I've educated this child of mine who goes away and she comes back with these strange, new, different habits. And he took it as an affront.
As if it's a rejection of what you were, you came from, what right. you learned from him, which it wasn't. It's an addition.
It's an addition.
But it can feel scary to the people who love you mm-hmm. if they have a sense of some distance being created because you're going into an unknown mm-hmm. to them.
Yeah, and I think the food is just symbolic, Right. It's not really the food that he's upset about. And so that to me is like emblematic of this process, right? And so when I finished, you know, I get through that, I graduate, right? And then I'm confronted with, okay, now what have I done? Who am I now? And I'm not this or that now. I'm this other hybrid thing. I'm something that combines what I was before I entered and what I am now that I've passed through this way. And to me, that's why I think it's not just me. There are a lot of Black women writing, and the writing emerges and pushes and pulls against traditional genre because we don't actually fit in some neat place that people would like to assign us.
And I love that you are allowing it and insisting on it in a way of saying, this is how Kin, you know, practically true stories, this is how this works.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what it is. Like you, and you take, it's not the pieces of it, it's the all of it.
Right.
And they might not seem like, usual neighbors in a, but they should be, or why not?
Why not? And I think Gene Toomer, that's part of why, you know, Gene Toomer appealed to me so much, because he was like breaking the box way back when. And this is published 100 years after Gene Toomer.
I mean, which is kind of mind-blowing, too, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because then it was pointed to as more like modernism, mm-hmm. or so. So like, this is so strange. It must be modern.
Right.
And then what happened to all of us? I don't know.
But I he gave me a pathway, you know, he gave me something to look at when I was like, see, it's not so strange, it's not so unusual that we might need to have a lot of different types of expression in one place in order to convey a whole.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And evoke the feeling of what it is.
Yeah. But I do know it challenges people.
Do you mind?
No.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
And so when you say that, I do know it challenges people. Do you find that when you were on book tour, because the book came out in August 2024, and you went to a series of places, as one does.
Mm-hmm.
Luckily for book tour, it seems like book tour isn't a given anymore. But were people saying to you that this was challenging or this was?
Yes.
Okay.
And quite honestly, the book terrifies me too, in some ways.
How so?
Well, there are a couple of things. The publication of this book will always be wrapped up in the loss of my father, because he died in August 2024, and the book was published in August 2024. And so, it's going to always be like, that's life. You know, life and death walk hand in hand. And so you have these wonderful things and you have these very painful things. And sometimes, and I think Kin kind of conveys all of that. You know, it's like, because the book, the reason the book terrifies me is because I'm grappling with how do we love when there's so many difficult and painful, hurtful things that some of the people we love do to other people. And I mean, that's what it's about. How do you make this a life when it's like hurt and joy? It's like all the things together.
And there's so many, and many people are wounded.
Yes.
By it.
Yeah. And some of the people you love wound.
Yes.
Other people. And then what do you do? What do you do with that love? Where do you place it? How do you hold it? How do you transform it? What do you do? So that's why and I'm not sure that I intended to publish this book, I was writing because that's how I processed the world. And it was Dr. Melba Joyce Boyd called me. And she's like, don't you have something, girl?
Yes. Oh, love her.
Yeah. And she's like, oh, I'm sitting here and I think you might have something. I was like, well, maybe. Maybe I do. And I know that I'm always talking about home and family. That's
yes.
what I do.
Yeah. Or, well, I shouldn't say yet. I see it in here. Sorry, I don't mean.
Yeah. And so I was like, well, let me look at it and see if I do. Because I'm working on this other project. I've been working on it for a long time. And it's challenging the heck out of me. And so she calls me and I'm like, let me just look over here and see what I have. And then I saw it. I was like, oh, this is that tumor thing I've been working out, you know?
Yeah.
I could see it and I could congeal the pieces that came together for me.
Okay. Let's take a short break and then we'll come back and we'll talk more. Today on Living Writers, the Afua Prince is here in the studio. We've got Kin, Practically True Stories. You're listening to Living Writers. I'm Tia Hetzel. We've got Reverend Andrew behind the glass. We'll be back. Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. And today on the program, we have V. Afua Prince here. Her book, Kin, Practically True Stories. Such a great title. Such a great title. Thanks for picking the songs for today's show, too, Afua.
That was fun.
Why were some of the songs, like, what made you do your DJ picks for today?
Well, the Chuck Brown is because I'm a DC, I'm the DMV. I'm actually born. I was born in D.C., but I was raised
you were?
In Maryland. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, but raised in Virginia.
In Maryland.
Oh, Maryland. In Maryland.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Let's hear it from Maryland.
Chuck Brown is like the D.C. go-go, and you know, it's just a nod to my hometown. Yeah. So.
And Gene Toomer was also from D.C.
They migrated a lot, but D.C. there's a lot of writers and a lot of origin stories. I'm thinking, Brian Gilmore, who also was part of the Michigan Writers series, he a couple years back he published a book of poetry out of Wayne State University Press, but he just came out with another book about D.C. poets. But I think there is something to be said about the whole trajectory of writers, African-American writers in particular, out of D.C. and Maryland in particular. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
And so is that something you're thinking of maybe also?
Yeah, I just
got
to get through all of these many projects.
It's so good to have all the ideas, isn't it?
Yeah.
But then sometimes you see them out there floating or parts of them on your desk in different places and you're like, when is it your time? You know, this project over here or this idea.
Yeah, yeah. And then home, of course, you know, home. And that's what I That's what I spend time thinking about. And then The Wiz was just like this classic remake of The Wizard of Oz, and this notion of when I think of home, you know, I just nostalgic, and home is often a difficult place, which is why she's thinking about home, because she didn't want to be there. That's why she went off to see the wizard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. It's so complicated, right? It's mm-hmm. so, well, Fua, would you mind reading something from Kin for everyone now?
Okay. Well, I mean, I picked this little piece to, like, share. It's out of June. It's the second part of June, because it kind of answers, or not answers, it speaks to some of the core questions that motivate the book. Okay, that's two. What's left? Memory. But where is it lodged? In the brain as images? In the flesh as disease or scar tissue, in the air like a virus, in the soil like seed, in the marrow of bone.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about June and what are ways to describe it? Because there's visuals in Kin. Mm-hmm. There's a photograph, for example, of Aunt Clydie mm-hmm. in the central section of the book. But for June, it seems like there's phases of the moon.
Yes.
Can you talk about how you were using that as a structure? Mm-hmm. Because it allows you to use... to roam over many pages with these phases of the moon, and to do different lengths for each of the sections or pieces, or how you talk about it instead of me like trying to root around.
Well, June, I'm not sure exactly how June began. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the origins of June. But what I know is I was trying to think about sexual violence and what it means and where it emerges from. And the moon, of course, is often associated with women and yin, and like in the yin-yang, you know, complement. The yin is often mysterious and dark and feminine and water, and the menstrual cycle, right? Mm-hmm. So it is also loosely a calendar, a month, right? And so I was like, let's go through the month. Just think about a month as a way of measuring time. So June is about a measure of time. And June and Juno... is associated with marriage and love. And all of these ideas get conflated, which again is why there are all these little pieces or bigger pieces. It's like trying to get a sense of a whole by encapsulating all of these things that go into the ideas that I was trying to understand in relationship to sexual violence.
And it goes from historical moments of many different kinds. Mm-hmm. I think it ends on a historical note of violence too. Of like it's just, and there, it feels like there's some that are personal, like a personal narrative. Mm-hmm. And when you said, I don't even remember how June started, it echoed for me a line in June, I think, where the speaker says, I don't know how I got off the porch.
Yeah. Yeah. So June is painful. It's one of those painful places for me when I think about, because, I mean, sexual violence is painful, right? And it's so pervasive. I mean, I've been a professor for a long time, and I've encountered many, many students who are challenged on both sides of it. We think about sexual violence in slavery as far as they talk about the women. We don't ever question about what happened to men under slavery. It seems preposterous to imagine that the boundaries of violence are so neatly kept. And in terms of my family, there is a lot of history of sexual trauma. And my father was a sex offense detective. And so I grew up with a certain kind of awareness where my dad was always trying to caution me. And he would, I can't remember how many times he told me, I can't even begin to tell you. I will not try to tell you how pervasive this is because you'd never leave the house.
You wouldn't leave it. Yes. And you were his one daughter with among the sons as well.
Yes. Yeah. And so it's just excruciating for me to watch on all of the levels. And I'm like, why is this so pervasive? What is happening? And so in June, that's how I, you know, the questions in the part two is like, where is this memory? Where does it reside? And so that's how I, you know, I kind of suggest at the end of that section, it's in the bone, it's in the blood of the bone, the place where the blood is enriched and created and, you know, restored. It's in that place. And so if it's there, that means it's moving. It's moving throughout the body.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And in June, some of the sections are also, you mentioned being a college professor. Mm-hmm. There's a statistical section mm-hmm. that talks about percentages on university campuses.
Mm-hmm. It's fictionalized. There's nonfiction, but it's fictionalized because I'm trying to, again, convey a sense of a whole and not expose any, because I don't think it's really an individual problem. I think a global problem.
Yes.
But my area tends to be focused on the United States. So I'm really usually talking about what's happening here at home in the United States. I don't want it to feel like it's some individual problem when it's really something deeper and more structural.
And so in June, you show that by moving in the section 13, for example, it's Virginia is a metaphor for the new world. Mm-hmm. So it's a one line section and it's connecting more of like a historical moment.
Right. Well, Virginia is important in June and elsewhere for me because it's a threshold, right? When the Pilgrims left, they were headed for Virginia. They didn't make it to Virginia. They ended up on Plymouth Rock. But they were headed to Virginia. So Virginia is like a threshold for this place that they identified as the New World.
And there's moments and it goes back and forth with historical moments like Captain John Smith might have been here. Like in this on this land where now the porch that I'm standing on is, there's moments where you say there are no heroes, villains neither.
I'm trying to show that binaries are false. It's simple dichotomies, simple evil and good, light, dark, right, wrongs are very hard to measure. June is disruptive of that.
Yes. Mm. Because it definitely there's moments where where you're asking to look at the other, like the person who may be the rapist, like to think of that person as well in this scenario. Like what?
Yeah. I mean, I think about students and I mean, it's just a complicated mess because people are here and I'm not one for capital punishment. I'm not one for war. So if we're not trying to kill each other, then we have to live together. How do we do that? How do we manage it all?
And to try to address some of that, you move to like the global like wars in other nations and how rape is used to destroy communities by watching, you know, so it's interesting how you do, how what June does is it's moving on so many levels and through time in so many different ways, and the structure of what you found for June allows for that, for this total experience of it, but in such like these seemingly fragmented moments that when they're all together, you see the relationship among them and the feel of.
Yeah. And to me, you know, the rotation of the moon, you know, is like that. So like you look at this object and at one point it looks like a little slither and then it keeps transforming because it's turning around and you're seeing it in different ways from different moments.
And it's always there.
It's always
but it
there.
It looks different.
And it looks different, right? Even then, like the new moon, it's dark. And it's because of how you're seeing it. And so that's what I was doing. I'm like taking this object and turning it around and turning it around over a cycle.
I'm so glad you included the moons in this, too. It seems so important for the piece. Let's take a short break. Today on Living Writers, I'm lucky to be speaking in the studio with Thee Afua Prince. Her book, Kin, Practically True Stories, out with Wayne State University Press. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers, and we'll be back.
Hey, hey. I want to fold clothes for you. I want to make you feel good. Baby, I wanna do the right thing. Feel so much better than the wrong thing. I say I wanna fold clothes for you. I wanna make you feel good. Baby, I wanna do the right thing. Feel so much better than the wrong thing. I wanna fold clothes for you. I wanna fold clothes for you. Woke up this morning feeling like the best version of me. So happy I walked in the living room and saw you all alone on the couch, just napping. I see a lot on your plate. Now I muscle that weight. I know you're tired, so I wonder how I can help. I get the basket and grab the clothes out the trap. Oh.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today, Thee Afua Prince is here in the studio. Her book, Kin, Practically True Stories. Afua, thank you so much for coming today. Is there another short piece you'd like to read?
I'm trying to see.
Any length? Like, yeah.
Well, I'm thinking because we were just listening to J. Cole. I was trying to see if there's... Okay, here's a poem. Here's a poem. And it's short. It's after Reapers in Cain by Jean Toomer. Black washer with her knuckles raw on steel is rubbing rags. I see her place the heel of her hands upon the board, her back bowed, and start her steady bobbing, dark eyes shrouded. Black kitten prowls by the base of a tree, and there a black snake, startled, starts to flee, his belly surfing the ground. I see the board, swollen from all the washings. Bless the Lord.
Thank you. Thanks, Afua. So a lot of Kin is about women's work, family, making family, and washing. And this moment, why did you choose this one to read like this in this moment, and how is it figuring into your current work and thinking?
Yeah, well, in Kin, that's the beginning of my current work. There's a piece in there, Washer. It's about the Washer Women's Strike of Atlanta. It's called Water Bearers. And it became a play. It started off as more like a June piece with all of these little pieces. Huh. And then I kept, well, I actually shared it with a colleague of mine when I was teaching at Allegheny College. I just sent it to her and I was like, when you got time, if you feel like it, I just want you to read this. I just wrote this thing. I don't know what it is. And she read it and she was Beth Watkins. I'll give her a name.
Oh, yes. Shout out to Beth.
Shout out to Beth. I owe her a phone call. She read it and then she said, I see this on the stage. And I was like, me too. I didn't want to influence her in that way. I just wanted to know if she thought what she thought. And she's like, I see it on the stage. I was like, me too. Except I had never written a play.
Oh.
So I didn't know what a play, in what you had to do to write a play.
So how did you figure, like, what did you do next?
Well, she said, I want to have the students read this. I want to stage it. And I was like, cool, can I watch?
Amazing.
So she took it and she was describing the different pieces of it. And she's like, it's got so much history and it's got all of this drama. And then she said, and it's so funny. And I was like, funny?
Wait, I mean, yeah, I feel like there was a time where I did. I can't find it right now with my pages here, but yes.
Well, when she had the students performing it and I watched the rehearsals, I watched the whole process, but the final night when they were on stage reading it, I was cracking up and I was looking at this and I was like, that woman is so crazy. And I was like, oh, that's me. Because I really, really, really enjoy doing laundry. And I'm very detailed about how it should be done. And then
the opening, I think, has these personal moments that are from perhaps your life where you say you graduate. And you've just had the baby, you just graduate, and then you move to Flint.
Well,
is this,
that's
or
not,
is this, it's fictionalized there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the first thing this character does is buys a Kenmore.
Well, that part is true.
Oh, okay.
It is literally the first thing I was still a graduate student, but I had the baby while I was, I had two babies while I was in grad school. But the first baby, I was like, I need a washing machine. This is impossible without my own washing machine. I'm really fascinated with laundry.
And now this is carrying on. So we've got this play, which is the second play in mm-hmm. Kin, mm-hmm. because after you read the preface, you come to the first play is a wonderful
period.
Because it's talking also of these three friends back together mm-hmm. with and they're in their 50s now, mm-hmm. but they were grad students together. Mm-hmm. Three women in one program together. And it was so interesting how when you were talking about the preface, it seemed to me like, oh, now I see why you chose period to be the lead.
Yes. Well, that is a fiction inspired by friendships that I have. But the question there is about what happens to the womb after, like, it's used up its usefulness. Like, really, it's about menopause and perimenopause and those women who choose not to give birth to a child. But it is about mothers. So there's an adopted child and there are one woman has two children, one woman has three children. And then they go off and they're trying to escape for a few moments their lives.
And they're in the Caribbean.
I call them the long married.
Yes.
And so they're the long married women who just have this regular way that they try to retreat and their lives keep chasing them, lives catch up to them.
So by the time you got to this, did you see this coming as a play because you'd already written the first one?
Yes. So Beth Watkins, shout out again to Beth, she taught me a lot. And so that by the time I got to period, I knew I was trying to write a play.
And why did you know that? Like, what was it about the one act form that really you felt like, oh, I see this. This is the vehicle.
Because the women in my mind had to be embodied. So even though we're reading it on the page, I could also see the women. I thought the women needed to be physically in the round, like we needed to be in the space with these women. Because really, Ken is about family, but it's also about the women. It's about the women who are working. People don't understand how much is involved or don't give enough credit and time to how much is involved with holding a family together. And so in many of the places in Ken, it's about how family, the work of family making.
And has that something that you have been like, that was something that you just feel like you saw happening in the work and then you made it more intentional? Or
I think the intent, my work and the intent to talk about home and family from the time I was in grad school, I did not realize I wasn't supposed to have children while I was in grad school. I didn't, for some reason that escaped my
that it might make it a bit harder.
Right. It never occurred to me. I was like, oh, I'm about that time and age. I think this is what you do. That, but the community I came from, that's what I understood. But nobody had gone to get a PhD. Up until this point, I'm still the only one in my extended family. That's not what we did. So I didn't know. I just thought, oh, okay, you have children, you work, you do whatever you do. But it became clear to me that if I did not turn my attention to the thing that was the most difficult and proving to be an obstacle toward my degree, I would never finish my degree. So I started focused on a different thing. But by the time I'm writing a dissertation, I'm writing about home and family because that's what was challenging me. It had to become the subject. Because otherwise it was just going to be the obstacle.
Yeah, you'd just have to keep fighting it.
Right. And it would win. It would win. So I was determined to get my degree. So I was like, well, then I have to write so that I can understand why my family and my home life is proving so difficult in this process.
And you haven't looked back.
No, it terrifies me because I love my family. And sometimes they recognize themselves. and that's hard because we don't want to talk about difficult things in families. It's much easier for me to, like Anne Freight, to write to my diary, right. You know. But I believe in the value of, it's not just me and my family, you know. It's family. It's a dynamic. It's a thing. It's a structure. It's an institution. And other people, I have learned, desire this information.
And need these stories.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Afua, for coming today to talk on Living Writers, for
Thank
this conversation.
You. Thank you for having me.
It's been wonderful.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this conversation.
Today on Living Writers, the Afua Prince, her book, Kin, Practically True Stories, out with Wayne State University Press. I'm T. Hetzel. Thanks everyone out there for listening. Thanks to the Rev for engineering today, seeing us through. Thanks to JAV for pulling together Afua's songs. Thanks to Mom for listening. And until next time, I'm T. Hetzel. All these
than 4011 gold dust twins. Lord, I do more work than 4011 gold dust twins. Got myself aching from my head down to my chin.
The report from the world of sports on WCPN.
Good evening, Ann Arbor. It is 6 p.m., which means it is time for your version of the Daily Sports Report on WCBN FM 88.3. I'm your host, Paul. Today we got a full panel. Got Bowen, got Jack, got Jake, we got Caleb. How are we doing today, guys?
Good, good. It's I haven't been on one of these in a while, and I'm excited to talk about some Michigan hoops.
Let's do it. So,
all right, yep. Today, you might have guessed it based on, you know, what happened in the Chrysler Center in Ann Arbor last night. We are talking Michigan basketball, number three team currently in the land. Tough victory. Undefeated, number five, Nebraska. Came in hot. Certain guys... Jaquez Lawrence, I'm not going to get into that. I just feel every team I root for, random role players that don't really score a lot or do a whole lot, go off against my team. 18 first half points, shooting like 4 of 5 from three, just crazy stuff. And Nebraska held, you know, that 6-7 no pun intended, point lead the entire, for most of the game. But Trey McKinney, tough bucket. Michigan wins in a battle, 75-72 as time expired. And we'll just go around real quick. Thoughts on, you know, good, what you thought, positive.